more as it is revealed to us how bad it is. But here's William Safire's take on it. You're a suspect. And if this doesn't frighten you, and if he doesn't think we're heading into this, I don't know what will. We really need to do something about this. But he goes on and says, every purchase you make with a credit card, every magazine subscription you buy, and medical prescription you fill, every website you visit, email, he just goes on and on talking about how the government with this Homeland Security Act is going to be able to investigate the most minute detail of your life, your bank account, your transactions, on and on. Everything you do financially, your choices of food, you know, you go to the supermarket and whatever you buy, that's all on tape now and so forth. And he says, this is not some far out Orwellian scenario. It is what will happen to your personal freedom in the next few weeks. And that $200 million dollars has been created to get a dossier on every one of us here in America. Now, we're seem to be heading into this Orwellian state, and unless people care to do something about it, that's where we're headed. And I think we have an obligation here to speak out against it, if anyone would have a suggestion as what can actually be done about it, I would certainly, maybe we don't have time this week, but we'd certainly talk about it. But maybe you might think about that for the next week. What can actually be done about this? I've had people come up to me and just very candidly, very caringly and openly saying, you know, I usually don't pay much attention to politics, but I'm hearing more and more what's going on, and I don't like the direction this country is headed, and I'm actually losing sleep, they say, about what can we do about it, because it's just becoming ever increasingly obvious that we're headed into some kind of Orwellian police state, and I really don't know what to do about it, they tell me. And so I'm putting this out for the next week. Maybe we can talk about it when I see you next Monday evening. What can we as individuals do about this? Work with our limited amount of time, money, and energy, where can we best put that into changing things, to actually really honestly changing things? Not just talking about them, not going on to endless seminars, not endlessly just merely... Well, I see we're out of time. Next week, then.
Well, I'm glad someone keeps out there thinking, you know.
Oh, yes.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. Of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. But before we get to our very, very special guest this evening, I want to simply mention that a week from tomorrow, that's the 10th of December, Mike Kaprutka is going to be speaking there in Spokane. He's going to be speaking at the Shiloh Inn at 923 East 3rd Street at 7 o'clock in the morning. There's no fee. He's going to talk about what would America be like if we had a million lawyers like Patrick Henry. So again, Mike Kaprutka from the Institute of Constitutional Studies will be speaking in Spokane there at the Shiloh Inn at 923 East 3rd Street, 7 o'clock in the evening, a week from tomorrow, no fee for getting in there. And, of course, you'll be fascinated by Mike's presentation and beginning to understand why our Constitution is so vitally, vitally important. Well, right now, let me introduce our very special guest for this evening. His name is Howard Phillips. He ran for the presidency on the Constitution Party ticket all across America. And the reason maybe you haven't heard of him is because the establishment doesn't want you to hear of him. Certainly, he wasn't allowed on any of the major debates at all. They just want to give you the choice between Socialist Party A and Socialist Party B. Both want big government, both favor the New World Order, the trade with Red China, and of course, Howard certainly represents the voice of moderation, the voice of the Constitution, the voice of the Constitution Party. Howard, thank you so much for being with us.
Dr. Stan, it's always a pleasure.
Well, we were, of course, going to be talking this evening a little bit about, well, we're going to talk a lot of things, but right now I know one of the things that you're so concerned about is this new commission that the establishment has founded for the continuity of government. What's this all about? What are they talking about, continuity of government?
Well, Stan, let me approach it this way. In 1941, there was a sneak attack on Pearl Harbor. Most Americans were shocked, although people in positions of leadership probably knew much of what was about to occur. There's good reason to believe that the president and his colleagues knew that the attack on Pearl Harbor was coming. But for most Americans, it was a sneak attack. I think we're in danger of having a sneak attack on the Constitution. The background is this. Since September 11, all Americans are aware of our country's vulnerability. And I think most Americans recognize, as I do, that we could face a disaster far more serious than that which we experienced on September 11, 2001. It could be a nuclear terrorist attack. It could be chemical or biological. Clearly, people in government recognize that this is a possibility. President Bush has already taken steps to provide smallpox inoculations among health workers and members of the military, and various other things are being discussed. So we're talking about a real possibility. A continuity of government commission was established taking advantage of the potential of a terrorist threat which could decapitate our government, which could result in the incapacity or even the death of leaders of the executive, judicial, and legislative branches. And what they're doing is using that possibility as the occasion for proposing changes in the Constitution of the United States to potentially, in effect, create a provisional government in the event of attack. Now, let me say clearly at the outset, I am in no position to tell you with certainty that the proposals that will be forthcoming from COG, the Continuity of Government Commission, will be comprehensive or with certainty disastrous or misdirected. We have to act prudently. We have to wait and see what their product is before we evaluate that product and determine whether it might be something with which we could agree or more likely something which would cause us concern. My concern is that unless constitutional conservatives recognize that the continuity of government commission is preparing constitutional amendments which will be made public in late December or early January, we could face a situation in which these proposals are rushed through the Congress and the state legislatures without serious debate. And this has happened before in American history. In the midst of crisis, significant changes have been made to the Constitution, and it's very difficult to put it back the way it was once that has happened. So I want to make sure that there are millions of constitutional conservatives who know this is coming, so it won't be a sneak attack, who will be prepared to evaluate the product of this commission, and who, in some cases, will be sufficiently knowledgeable to critically evaluate COG, or the Continuity of Government Commission's work product on radio and television interview shows, in op-ed pieces, and so forth. To that end, Stan, I've been in touch with the great lady of American conservatism, Mrs. Phyllis Schlafly, and she has agreed to head up a counter-commission, which will closely monitor the work of the Continuity of Government Commission, and which will have in its membership people who will be prepared to comment on COG's recommendations when they become public, presumably in early January. So that's the state of play. And Stan, let me just say that the Continuity of Government Commission is proceeding under the auspices of two establishment Washington-based foundations. One, the American Enterprise Institute, which is a Republican establishment foundation, and the Brookings Institution, which is a Democrat establishment institution. The honorary co-chairmen of the Continuity of Government Commission are former presidents Jimmy Carter and Gerald Ford, and the working leadership of the commission consists primarily of Lloyd Cutler, who was one of those who served as legal counsel to President Bill Clinton, and former U.S. Senator from Wyoming, Alan Simpson, who's very close to the Bush family. Others involved in it include Nicholas Katzenbach, the former Attorney General of the United States under Lyndon Johnson, and Robert Michael, who was Republican minority leader in the U.S. House of Representatives prior to the election of Newt Gingrich to that post in the early 1990s. The Continuity of Government Commission has received funding from the Carnegie Foundation, from the Hewlett-Packard Foundation, and from the MacArthur Foundation. And I've had the opportunity to attend one of their meetings that was open to the public. Not all of their sessions are public. And I am personally closely monitoring their work and hope to play a part in seeing to it that they do not do damage to the Constitution.
Well, I really appreciate the fact that you're back there right in the very belly of the beast there and that you're keeping an eye on these things because, you see, I don't think the average individual, certainly across America, has any idea what's going on or the fact that there really are people who would like to change our way of life, our form of government. These are people who seem to march to a different drumbeat, who dream a different dream, who really think we'd be far better off with sort of a more authoritarian system than this clumsy Republican framework of government that that we've had that has worked so well for so many years.
Well, you know, Stan, over the years, many things have happened to chip away at our structure of constitutional liberty under our federal republic. And some of them have taken the form of presidential executive orders, presidential declarations of emergency, and statutes such as the USA Patriot Act and the Homeland Security Act. Now, I've got problems with all of those things, but as bad as many of those things are, they are not permanent. the Homeland Security Act, the USA Patriot Act, can be undone by Congress just as it was done in the first place by Congress. Presidential executive orders and declarations of emergency can be rescinded if we ever have a president supportive of the Constitution who wants to do so. But once a change has been made in our organic law, in the Constitution itself, if that change is a bad one, it's very difficult to undo that kind of damage. We're still suffering from some of the unwise amendments which were hastily added to the Constitution in years gone by, including the 16th Amendment and the 17th Amendment and some others I could name.
Well, certainly the 14th Amendment, at least the way it's being interpreted now, to justify the centralization of all power in Washington, D.C., which, of course, was exactly the opposite from what our founding fathers believed.
And, of course, Stan, as you well know, there are questions about whether the 14th Amendment was legitimately ratified. The southern states were told, A, that they weren't part of the Union because of their supposed rebellion, and they were told, B, that if they wanted to be back in the Union, they had to ratify the 14th Amendment. So these states, which were under military authority, and which were not at the time of their decision to ratify, considered to be part of the Union, once they ratified, became part of the Union. And there are serious questions about the validity of that approach. And of course, before the 14th Amendment was adopted, it was understood that we were citizens of the state to which we belonged, and by virtue of that fact, we were citizens of the United States. In other words, the United States, these United States, plural, received their power in the sense of the Federal Republic having power from delegations of authority by the states. But after the 14th Amendment, it was turned upside down, and we were presumed to be citizens of our states only by virtue of our citizenship of the U.S.
And I think it's so vitally important that people understand our Constitution, understand there's been an organized effort going back almost 200 years to change that because there have always been there those who wanted power.
Well, even back to the days of Alexander Hamilton, as you well know, Stan, one of his goals was to create a central bank that would benefit the financial interest with which he was politically associated. And throughout the years, whether it was the battle over the First National Bank of the U.S. or the Second Bank of the U.S., which was ultimately won by a great president, Andrew Jackson, or whether it was the Federal Reserve System brought into being in 1913, as Jefferson put it in his correspondence with John Adams, after they reconciled in 1813, the issue today, said Jefferson, is the same as it has been throughout all history, whether man shall be allowed to govern himself or be ruled by a small elite.
And I think that is really so true. Well, actually, a week from today, Howard, Mike Perutka is going to be out there in Spokane, where, of course, this is being broadcast tonight in eastern Washington on 4 stations for the American Christian Network, and he's going to be talking about the Constitution, about our history, and I do hope many of our listeners will go down there to the Silo Hotel. I hate to have him miss an evening with us here on Radio Liberty, but he'll be speaking at the Silo Hotel. That's a week from tomorrow, the 10th of December, beginning at 7 o'clock. And that,
well, let me second the motion. Michael Perutka is a great American who is doing an extraordinary job to promote an understanding of the Constitution. He's also a very warm and witty man, and I'm sure that those who hear him speak will never forget his presentation. I think it'll be as enjoyable as it will be educational, and I heartily applaud the work that Michael Perutka is doing, and I am very glad that you're exposing this opportunity to your listeners in the Spokane area?
Well, I think people have to understand what they believe in. They have to understand the foundation of our freedom before they can understand the significance of what's going on today. Our founding fathers would roll over in their graves if they were to read the text of the USA Patriot Act, which, of course, redefines terrorism. It has nothing to do with Islamic terrorism, and the sooner the American people understand that, the better. The whole thing redefines terrorism. There's not one word about Islamic terrorism in that. They simply are using this to massively expand government control of our lives, in the essence of repeal the Fourth Amendment and increment by increment.
It basically lets, among other things, it lets the federal government perform what an organized crime they call black bag jobs on unsuspecting citizens. They can enter our homes without prior knowledge and not even tell us that they've been there and taken things until 90 days after the fact. It's extremely troubling, and as you said, it's a backdoor way of overriding, circumventing, undermining the Fourth Amendment to the United States Constitution, which was put there to protect the American people against unreasonable searches and seizures.
And I think that until the American people understand that this has nothing to do with Islamic terrorism, there's not one word, at least I've seen, in that talks anything about Islamic terrorists. They simply redefine what a terrorist is. And then, of course, they justify anything they do in the name of fighting not Islamic terrorism, but simply anyone who they classify as a terrorist, and the classification is so loose that you're going to have a very difficult time determining what is a terrorist. In fact, potentially anyone in the listening audience could be a terrorist if they were the government wanted to label you as such, and then, of course, you have no right to defend yourself. And the frightening things that are going on today, where they are putting people in detention. They have all these people they arrested immediately after 9/11. I mean, they arrested, I don't know, well over 1,000 Middle Eastern men. And how did they know immediately after the 9/11 attack who these people were? And then some of them are still, well over 100 are still in detention, and the government won't even release their names.
Well, Big Brother certainly is watching us.
Right.
And we assume that the folks in Washington know more than we do. Whenever a congressman casts a bad vote, one of the lame excuses is, well, there are things that I know that I can't tell you that caused me to vote this way. And then when they will blindly follow a president who hasn't produced evidence to a particular policy, they say, well, the president knows things that we don't know. But the reality is that when they are called upon to vote on these horrendous, unconstitutional pieces of legislation, they vote irresponsibly. For example, Ron Paul made a statement recently in which he pointed out that when the Homeland Security bill came to the floor of the House of Representatives, more than 400 pages in length, the copies of the bill had only been made available to members of Congress 2 hours prior to the vote. And I'm willing to wager that there wasn't a single member of Congress who in that two-hour period was enough of a speed reader to go through carefully all of those 400-plus pages.
Well, you know, what they do is they do this intentionally so that the congressman can't read the legislation. In fact, Senator Byrd recently on the floor of the Senate criticized himself for voting for it, and he said, you know, one of the other senators had warned you shouldn't be rushed into voting for this USA Patriot Act, and he said, I was, and I was wrong. I wish I hadn't voted for it.
Senator Byrd deserves credit for that confession of error.
And of course, then he, of course, was talking about the Office of Homeland Security. Now, most people think that that this whole debate had to do something with civil service, and why were they arguing over civil service? But of course, Senator Byrd, well, why don't you certainly are closer to what was going on back there. Senator Byrd was trying to tell the American people the significance of the Office of Homeland Security legislation.
Well, basically what this new bureaucracy does is in many ways give the federal government more power over many aspects of our lives. We're talking about additional billions of dollars being spent We're talking about, I believe, some 22 major federal agencies being brought together under the jurisdiction of a single cabinet secretary. It is, in fact, the biggest reorganization of government since the creation of the Defense Department in the years immediately following World War II. And even though it's about homeland security, it does not include the Central Intelligence Agency or the Federal Bureau of Investigation, whose work in the area of homeland security supposedly is essential to the success of the effort. You know, Stan, as you know, when a business executive is in trouble, or when a politician has a problem that he can't solve, the easy answer is to propose a reorganization. It doesn't solve any problems, but it keeps people busy for a while, and it has consequences that can't always be foreseen. Back in the early 1970s, I think this was in the late 1960s, I was in the Nixon administration for a period of about 5 years. I headed two agencies, and I remember one day I was brought over to a meeting at the new executive office building, in which a fellow named Dwight Inc., who was an associate director of the Office of Management and Budget, spoke, and he was announcing Richard Nixon's new plan to create 10 regional governments around the country. And they talked about things like revenue sharing and blah, blah, blah. And this whole scheme was comprehensively unconstitutional. What it did was not bring the federal government closer to the states or the people. It took it just another step further away, created new entities, and then ultimately I was the head of the agency which Lyndon Johnson created, the U.S. Office of Economic Opportunity, which I tried to eliminate. And when I was director of that agency, I had to cope with the bureaucrats in 10 regional agencies, each of whom were powers unto themselves, with authority far greater than that in many respects of any elected official in the states under their jurisdiction. So all of these reorganization schemes at least potentially carry serious problems, making government less accountable and much more expensive.
And you know, nothing really has changed. I was just preparing for my latest newsletter, reading about what happened in 284 AD when Diocletian became the emperor. And of course, everything was in chaos in Rome because they had this tremendously centralized government. And so he tried to decentralize government and bring the inflation into control by imposing wage and price controls. By this time, of course, they had destroyed the value of their currency by inflation, by and everything that, of course, happened in to Rome at that time is going on right here in America today, except Diocletian tried to decentralize the Roman government. And what are we doing? We're taking 22 agencies and 170,000 federal employees and putting them into a centralized authority and saying, this is going to protect us from the Islamic terrorists who we didn't know who they were, except the 2 hours.
Well, well-meaning people are always suckers for the idea of political reform and incremental reforms. And as a result, constitutional conservatives are frequently put in a situation where they're forced to wrestle with 22 different tentacles of the same octopus. And they dissipate their financial resources, their time, and their energy fighting with those tentacles, when in fact they should be trying to eliminate the octopus.
Amen to that.
And so much of what the federal government does today is unconstitutional. We must not fall into the trap of thinking that we can reform an unconstitutional agency or program such as the Department of Education. The answer isn't reform, it's abolition. Same thing with the income tax. Until 1913, the revenue tariff was the principal source of income for the federal government, and that placed a limit on what the federal government could spend. Because if the tariff was too high, people would not purchase the products and the revenues would decline. When we move from the revenue tariff to the income tax as the principal source of revenue for the federal government, it meant that there was no upper ceiling on what the federal government could attempt to extract from the people. And then when you added to the IRS the Federal Reserve System, where they could manipulate the money supply, and while we weren't looking on a daily basis, diminish the value of our savings and earnings, all of those things have contributed to federal power. The answer is not to reform the Fed. The answer is not to reform the tax system. The answer is to go back to the original constitutional framework where Congress, under Article 1, Section 8, was given authority to coin money, regulate the value thereof and of foreign coin, and to fix the standard of weights and measures so that you couldn't turn our savings and earnings into funny money. And then under the original design, the federal government was not able to impose gift taxes, estate taxes, capital gains taxes, income taxes, Social Security taxes, etc., on individual Americans. The states were a buffer between the federal government and the people, and the federal government had to rely on excises, imposts, duties, and apportionment among the states. And that limited the power of the federal government. It preserved the role of the states. It enhanced the liberty of the people. And that is what, God willing, we will someday have once again whenever we have presidential and congressional leadership that takes seriously the oath taken to the Constitution of the United States.
And people must remember that liberty and limited federal government go hand in hand. Howard, how can people get in touch with you and with your organization?
Sure. If people want information about COG, the Continuity of Government Commission, or if they want to learn more about the work of the Conservative Caucus and our weekly television program, Conservative Roundtable, etc., they can fax me their name and address at 703-281-4108. They can check out the website of the Conservative Caucus, www.conservativeusa.org, or they can write to me, Howard Phillips, TCC, 450 Maple Avenue East, Vienna, Virginia, 22182.
Vienna, Virginia. All right. Give me that zip code one more time.
That's 22182.
22182. And one of the things I wanted to mention was this television program, your weekly television program. I understand it's heard on 120 cable stations across America?
That is correct, Stan. And like you and the magnificent work you do with Radio Liberty, I understand the importance of reaching people through the electronic media, the mass media. So a number of years ago, 6 or 7 years ago, we started a weekly program called Conservative Roundtable. Now, we don't have a lot of money, so we can't buy time on television. But what we can do is use public access channels to broadcast the program. All we need is someone living in a particular cable jurisdiction who is willing to meet with the decision makers at the cable station and encourage them to regularly broadcast our weekly 30-minute program, Conservative Roundtable. This is a product of which your listeners can be proud, as I am. The quality is excellent. The visual quality is excellent. And the content is good, not because I'm the host, but because we have the best guests in the world who talk about what they're doing. And we've had more than 300 constitutional conservative leaders from around the country serve as guests on this program. And we've had some wonderful broadcasts. Michael Peruca was one of our guests, to whom you referred earlier. We had a program recently with Professor Daniel Dreisbach.
We're going to have to interrupt you there, sure. Howard. We're going to have to go to our break, and when we get back, we'll welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when I have to remind our listeners out across America that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and I know many of you will be listening on the Internet or listening on the archive programs, and of course, we don't charge for our programs, but we certainly hope that many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters and actually partnering with us as we reach out across America 5 hours every day on radio, on the Internet, on shortwave, on the satellite, and we have an opportunity to reach people throughout the world. It was fascinating at our recent conference why we had a gentleman who listens to us regularly over in Germany, and he had come over and flew up from Southern California to attend our program before going back to Germany. We have an opportunity to get people to understand these concepts of freedom, of this wonderful gift that we inherited from generations past, of this concept of freedom under God, because that's what it was all about. In America, freedom came from God, in contrast to every other nation in the world, where freedom comes from government, and what government gives, government can take away. Whereas the freedom of God is certainly not something that's negotiable with politicians. And so if you'd like to, of course, help us as we try to educate the people and make them understand that behind all the various machinations of what's going on today is a great spiritual battle that has been going on since the beginning of time, and there really is a conspiracy against God and his people that's described in Jeremiah 11:9 or Ezekiel 22:25. Why, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. If you'd like to get a copy of the October newsletter, it was Kristen Breitweiser's testimony before the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, looking into the background of what really happened on September 11th of last year. And of course, the television cameras were there and the reporters were there. But amazingly enough, why the very substance of her discussion was never mentioned by the media, and very, very few people know what she said. Well, you can get it down on the Internet, or we have it. I took my last month's letter, my October newsletter, and that is the very essence of that newsletter, is her testimony. It's one of the most gripping, most powerful bits of testimony. Her husband, Ron, died in the South Tower. And it's very touching, but it's also very informative and raises questions that neither the current administration or Henry Kissinger will address in the upcoming investigation. So if you'd like a free copy of that newsletter, our telephone number, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, that's 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. We'll be glad to send you a free copy of our October newsletter. You have to specifically request which one. If you haven't had a copy before, we're glad to get that to you with the hope that you'll want to be getting that on a regular basis. Go to our website at RadioLiberty.com, where you can hear our regular daily programs, Internet, live, actually 5 hours a day. And then, of course, hope that you'll tell others about our program. Tell others about our ministry. We'll be back in just a moment, and we'll welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California, 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Howard Phillips, formerly a presidential candidate for the Constitution Party. He chairs the Conservative Caucus and really a number of other organizations, but all aimed at educating the American people about the foundations of our freedom and the fact that we are tragically losing it. Well, before we get back to our discussion of the various programs that are being put on, and incidentally, if anybody in the listening audience would be interested in helping Mr. Phillips get the his programs heard on your local cable television, you can go ahead and fax him at 703-281-4108. They don't charge you, and I'm sure he can get those tapes to you, but the important thing to do would be to get them on every week, as they'll provide the tapes for you. And most of the cable television stations are quite willing to do this. You just have to approach them, and then, of course, get the videotapes to them on a weekly basis. Again, the telephone number or the fax number to reach Mr. Phillips' office, 703-281-4108. 4108. And we've got Nathan on the line. Hi, Nathan. How are you doing?
Well, good evening, gentlemen. Good evening, Doctor. And good evening, Howard Phillips. It's a pleasure to speak to both of you. Let me make two points, and I think you're going to really want to comment on these, but I'll make both of them. For one, the first of all is that in 1798, there was a Supreme Court case, Calder versus Bull. This made it very, very clear that there were certain principles the government was not even allowed to touch, that in effect there was such a thing as higher law above and beyond what government at any level could do statutorily that restrained it. And I believe that this case should be looked into because it's basically saying that we retain our full natural liberties even in the midst of whatever statutes or laws Congress might pass or whatever the president might do by executive order or what have you. And this is also part of an overarching comment I'd like to make tonight is that one of the laws binding on the nations, one of God's laws that are binding on the nations is the commandment to uphold just courts. And, you know, it's not, in my opinion, simply a commandment to honor any old government. It's a commandment to honor just courts. And I don't frankly believe that we even have an option here. We must challenge anything that's unjust in the courts, and we must, you know, I'm surprised that the courts are so silent and in the face of all this unconstitutional statutory, in the face of all these unconstitutional statutory laws. And I think that we need to do it now before this becomes binding. And this becomes something that is simply accepted.
All right. Well, let's get Mr. Phillips' response to that. And then if you have another comment, we'll take that later. But Howard, how would you respond to what Nathan was saying?
Well, one of the great myths today is the myth of judicial supremacy, the idea that we can't undo a Supreme Court opinion without amending the Constitution. That's utter nonsense. The Supreme Court is under the Constitution, not over it. And there are many ways in which we can assert just constitutional principles, reassert the notions of higher law to which Nathan has referred. Article 3 of the Constitution gives Congress the power by simple majority vote to limit the appellate jurisdiction of the Supreme Court, whether it is with respect to abortion or quotas or forced busing or the death penalty, whatever it may be. Nowhere in the Constitution is the size of the Supreme Court defined. That's a matter for statutory definition. With respect to all of the courts inferior to the Supreme Court, they are statutory creations. They're created by law, by Congress and the President, and they can be abolished by law. Similarly, because they are statutory agencies, they are subject to the power of the purse. And whenever a particular judge or court below the Supreme Court level acts in a manner which is in conflict with the plain text of the Constitution, Congress can withhold funds from that court. Indeed, the President can veto funds for any legislation or veto any legislation which includes funds for such a court. And, in fact, the entire lower court system of appeals courts, district courts, courts of claims, etc., can be utterly revised by statute because, again, they are under the Constitution, not over it. One of the things that we must closely examine whenever someone is nominated to serve on the federal bench is whether this person does indeed acknowledge higher law, as Nathan has pointed out. One of the reasons I concluded that David Souter, for example, was an inappropriate nominee to the U.S. Supreme Court, and one of the reasons I testified against his confirmation, in addition to the fact that he had a very despicable pro-abortion record in his personal and public life, personal as a proctor at Harvard, public as a trustee of two hospitals. In addition to that fact, he was a legal positivist. I read his thesis that he wrote while a student at Harvard Law School, and in that thesis he rejected all notions of higher law, saying that man's reason is the ultimate arbiter of what law ought to be. So I think your caller has made some excellent points with which I agree.
And, of course, you were the only person, really, to testify against David Souter. He was put in, incidentally, by the Republicans. Seven of the current Supreme Court justices were Republican appointees. And, you know, of course, they told us, gee, we've got to get a Republican president because if Al Gore gets in, he's got to put in some terrible people on the Supreme Court. My fear is that when the Republicans get in, they put in even worse people on the Supreme Court.
Well, you know, there are a lot of Washington conservatives bleeding crocodile tears over Miguel Estrada, one of Bush's nominees to the Circuit Court of Appeals, who, for reasons which escape me, was blocked by Pat Leahy while the Democrats controlled the Judiciary Committee. But if you look at his record, as announced by Orrin Hatch, the new chairman of the Judiciary Committee, liberals shouldn't be at all unhappy with him because he's been an attorney for the National Organization for Women.
And this is a Bush appointee?
Yeah, this is someone who is proclaimed as one of these great Bush conservatives.
Right, and certainly the next Supreme Court justice, who's the fellow they're talking about?
About Alberto Gonzalez.
Gonzalez, and I mean, this fellow is so far to the left, and yet he's going to be put in by a conservative president of the Supreme Court.
I think you and I were both present, Stan, at a speech which Judge Gonzalez gave, in which he praised those presidents who in times of crisis had, in his words, been required to suspend the Constitution and disregard its plain text. And even some people who were at the outset very sympathetic to Judge Gonzalez, when they heard him say that, said, this fellow ought not be a Supreme Court justice.
And yet, of course, he is number one in line when somebody retires to replace him with the current administration. And maybe we ought to start rethinking some of our opinions. The current administration is nowhere near as pro-American and conservative as many misguided.
Yeah, let me make one other comment. You know, when he was running for the Republican nomination, President Bush criticized properly President Clinton for having U.S. troops under United Nations command. Indeed, the Republican platform of the year 2000 pledged that U.S. soldiers would not be placed under U.N. command. Nonetheless, today, they are not only serving under U.N. commanders, they are also receiving medals for their service to the United Nations, not from the Defense Department or the President of the United States, but from the Secretary General of the United Nations. Now, this is outrageous, but where do we see expressions of concern about this broken promise by President Bush?
Well, Nathan, do you have any other question or comment?
Well, once again, my basic point is this, that God's laws do command a system of just courts. Now, obviously, the Congress is given a judicial function under the Supreme Court, and I understand that there's a question about that, and that wasn't really my point, you know, as to who ultimately is supreme, and that wasn't really my point. My understanding is that Article 3 does say that the Supreme Court is an independent branch of government,
Congress can limit the appellate jurisdiction of the Supreme Court.
No, I understand, it does
right.
say that.
Right.
But see, the basic overarching point is that according to God's laws, and also according to common law, which is enshrined in the Constitution in the Seventh Amendment, according to the basic overarching, my interpretation of what these things say, no branch of government can pass any law that is immoral and that is against God's laws. And what I'm saying is that the American people need to make sure that this is what is being enforced. And we already have binding precedent. We have Calder versus Bull, which still stands as a binding precedent until this day, saying that there is higher law and that is in the Constitution.
Okay.
Well, what I'm saying is if we don't do this now, we may lose our chance forever.
You may be right. Thanks so very much, Nathan.
Okay, thank you.
Your points are well taken. And of course, I think it's really so vitally important that people realize that if the people won't speak out in defense of freedom, who will? Our founding fathers set up a system of checks and balances. That was the one of the amazing things about our Constitution, that Congress could negate the president, the president could negate Congress, the Supreme Court could overrule the Congress, but then Congress could limit the jurisdiction of the Supreme Court. It was checks and balances. And one of the things that Senator Byrd brought out so clearly with his discussion of the Office of Homeland Security is, you're doing away with the checks and balances, don't you see? But apparently there were only 9 senators who agreed with him. All the rest of them swept along in this this emotional response to the terrorists. And, of course, they unfortunately, we have real problems today. We have the Office of Homeland Security. We have the USA Patriot Act. We have all these programs being imposed that will restrict our freedom. Well, we've got John listening in Post Falls, Spokane. Hi, John. How are you?
I'm great.
Did you have a question or comment?
Yes. Honored to speak with you, gentlemen. With retirement of Helen Choeth, my former representative here in the 1st District, Idaho, and the defeat of Bob Barr, as I see it, we only have one member of the lower house that takes the Constitution seriously, and that would be Ron Paul of Texas.
Go ahead.
And my question for Howard Phillips is, why isn't he in Congress? I mean... I wish it were not the case, but I don't see him being president in my lifetime.
Well, the hope, you know, amazing things can happen if God intervenes. But Howard, John is saying that we really don't have very many people who support the Constitution. We've got a small number there, besides Ron Paul, who I think is doing an excellent job. But you know other people there who really do believe in the Constitution, don't you?
Oh yeah, there are some fine people. I don't agree with all of them all of the time, but there are some who are doing superb jobs in particular areas. Ron has started something called the Liberty Caucus, in which he brings together perhaps a dozen of his colleagues on a regular basis, and they have constitutional discussions. So Ron is not just casting courageous votes and explaining his votes; he's trying to bring others along, and there are some very fine people, albeit a small minority, in Congress. I think what your caller is suggesting is that I ought to be running for Congress. And let me say, I did that some years ago. I did run for Congress back in 1970, which I did at a fairly young age. I'm 61 now. In order for me to be elected to Congress today, I would need at least $1 million in a competitive district. And believe me, the Republicans would not let me get a free ride anywhere. They would dislike my presence in Congress even more than the Democrats would, because their hypocrisy would be pierced, and that's something they wouldn't want. I am not in any way a wealthy man, and I have spent a great deal of my own money to advance the causes in which I believe, but I do not have enough money to wage a successful campaign for Congress. And if there's somebody out there who has a significant amount of money, I'd be prepared to consider it, but it would take a great deal of money for someone whose views are as clear as mine happen to be to overcome the forces of political correctness and the power of the two major parties.
And you know, Howard, I really think that God has you where you are today. I mean, there's nobody who can articulate the conservative position more efficiently than you can, or certainly rally the small group of people who are dedicated to preserving this country as effectively as you can. I think you will do far more doing what you're doing than serving in Congress. I ran actually for Congress twice, and looking back, I'm so glad that I lost, because I really feel that perhaps I can be a small voice where I am now, whereas if I was in Congress, I'd simply be one of 450 people, three people, who are looking over your shoulder for the next election. And of course, there's always that carrot there being held out by the people who control the strings of the Republican Party. You know, if you want to get reelected, if you want to stay back here and do good, you're going to have to compromise and go along with us. So, John, I think your point, I know how you feel, but I really think Howard is doing so much more good in what he's doing today.
Well, let me agree with John in this sense. I was in the government for 4 or 5 years, and there's no question that if you're in the room where the decisions are being made, sometimes you can accomplish more in 30 minutes on the inside than you can in 30 years on the outside. But we have to be grateful for what God assigns us to do, and do the best we can, and constantly examine how we can most effectively put to use the resources which God has made available to us.
John, if I can make a suggestion to you, if there's any way you can get to Spokane a week from tomorrow night to the Silo Hotel where Mike Kaprutka is going to be speaking, there will be a lot of people from your area there, and maybe you can come up with a good candidate and then everybody get behind him, but I hope it'll be as good as Helen Sennewith.
Well, let me tell you that in the Spokane area, the Constitution Party has a superb leader in John Beale, and another fine man known to you, Stan, and that is Neil Davis. And there are some excellent people in the Constitution Party in Spokane. We've also got some excellent people in Idaho, and certainly Helen Chenoweth Haig is missed, but I don't think we've heard the last of her.
And sometimes I think that we're going to have to get people out of this idea that there are two political parties. Because, of course, if you have two political parties and you can control the leadership of both of them, why, you never give the suckers an even chance. Anything else, John?
Well, very little. Briefly, I guess some people are destined to be transmission and others are to be brakes. And people ought not to necessarily equate failure with those in Congress that merely act as brakes.
Right.
And, stop the bad stuff.
Oh, listen, we pray for Ron Paul all the time. He's doing a wonderful, wonderful job. Hey, thanks so much for calling.
Thank you.
Okay, let's go to Roy. Hi, Roy, where are you calling from?
Watsonville.
Okay, this is Rory.
Rory.
Okay. Question or comment?
Yeah, question. Mr. Phillips, I've always enjoyed your discussions and your insights. In the race here in California for a state controller, Tom McClintock was the Republican candidate, and I noticed in the vote totals that the Constitution Party candidate got something like 90,000 votes, and I don't know how it all shook out, but McClintock and the Democrat were in a dead heat, and I think Tom was like 10,000 votes behind. I did notice that the Constitutional Party's candidate was, his profession was he was a bus driver, and I don't know, he might be a CPA or something.
Let me tell you.
Can you give me some insights?
Our candidate was a fellow named Nathan Johnson of San Diego, who does drive a bus for a living. But let me tell you, he's one of the most brilliant, knowledgeable people I've met anywhere in the country.
Okay.
This is a superb man. He has been the state chairman of our party, which in California is called the American Independent Party.
Yes.
And he has raised a very high standard. He's a very knowledgeable and devout Christian man. And I think it's very important for us to understand that even when the Republicans may be running somebody who is a nice fellow and a qualified and a good guy and better than his opponent, when you elect the Republican Party, you're basically taking the conservative strength and throwing it in with a party structure, the leadership of which is pro-abortion, pro-homosexual rights. Well, as you know, I'm not from California, but I do follow it. One of the key figures in the GOP in California is a guy named Gerald Parsky,
right,
George Bush's man in California, and he's on the wrong side of almost all of these issues.
Right.
So, while there are certainly some good people on the Republican ticket running here and there, such as Ron Paul in the state of Texas, in general, I would argue that one of the greatest strengths we have as constitutional conservatives is to exercise our power of subtraction and to show our strength by pulling the maximum number of votes possible for those candidates who are across the board committed to a constitutional agenda.
Okay, I understand that, and I would say that I'm a constitutional conservative, but in a state like California where you've got this lefty Democrat lock on almost every office, a guy like Tom McClintock might have been a good candidate to get in there at least start some audits.
Well, let me say that I know Tom, and I do have a very high regard for him personally.
Yes.
He is a very fine man, but so is Nathan Johnson, and on principle, I think it's important to demonstrate that the American Independent Party, the Constitution Party, does have
balance of power potential. And that gives us the ability, even if we can't win in our own right in every case or in most cases, to at least force the Republicans to take note of the concerns we have and not run away from principles. I think if Bill Sutton, we had a great candidate for governor of California in Ron Gulkey. If people had known that Ron Gulkey existed, I think he might have won, because he had all of the strengths which people had hoped Bill Simon would have, and none of his weaknesses. As you know, Simon flip-flopped on sexuality, on abortion, on various other issues. He made assorted missteps.
Yeah, he's a weak candidate. He didn't even vote in various elections.
Yeah, I mean, it was a tragic disappointment.
Yeah.
And I deeply regret that our guy, Ron Gulkey, who I know very well, and just an outstanding guy with a great knowledge of government, a successful businessman, if he had had the resources, the media exposure, he would have become very competitive in that race, just as Jim Buckley in New York State back in 1970 became competitive and won a seat in the U.S. Senate against the incumbent Republican Charles Goodell and the Democratic nominee Richard Ottinger.
Mm. The other thought on, what was it, Nathan Johnson?
Nathan Johnson.
Was American Independent.
He's a terrific guy.
Yeah.
Just a
quick question. In glancing over, I didn't see any biographical information, but when it says bus driver, kind of throws you.
This guy is extremely well-read, extremely knowledgeable. He is someone who can speak with authority on almost any issue. You know, Jesus Christ was a carpenter, and I don't think we should draw conclusions about people's suitability for public service based on the particular occupation they hold. One of the great principles of Jeffersonian republicanism, and I say this without suggesting that I agree with Jefferson on everything, but one of the principles was that to be a free nation, we should be a nation of independent yeomen. And
correct.
Nathan Johnson's role driving the bus kept him busy, keeps him busy 8 hours a day, and he uses his other non-sleeping hours very productively. And let me tell you...
Howard, I'm going to have to interrupt you because we're out of time, but thank you so much,
take
Howard.
Care.
It's been a real pleasure to have you, and I'm looking forward to having you back on here again in the very, very near future.
Stan, keep up your great work, and thanks for having me on the show.
God bless you. Good night.
Yes, sir.
And this is the time when we have to say goodbye to our listeners up there in the great Northwest and ask you to pray for America, ask you to pray for revival, pray for our leaders and our ministers, but please remember to pray for our ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. Until tomorrow, may the Lord be with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 464-8295. 1-888-24-LIBERTY, 464-8295. But please hold your calls. We have with us this evening certainly one of my favorite guests. His name is Joel Skousen. He publishes the World Affairs Brief. And Joel, how are you tonight?
I'm just fine, Stan. It's always a pleasure to be with you.
It's always a pleasure having you on here. And, of course, did you have a pleasant Thanksgiving?
I did. It was just most pleasant. Had a private place up in the mountains, and so we had a real Thanksgiving atmosphere and some good family. And my son from your area was back in Utah to visit me, so we had a great time.
Okay, fine. Well, of course, lots of things are happening. In fact, the tempo of occurrences are picking up rapidly. I think many people were very disturbed at the attack on the hotels in Kenya, the failed attempt at bringing down one of the Al planes with shoulder-held missiles. Of course, we could have bought all those up at the end of the Afghan War. The CIA steadfastly refused to even consider that. And you have to ask yourself why you would want to leave those missiles in the hands of the terrorists. And there's so many things going on in the world that are so difficult to understand. And, of course, my impression is that Joel has some very unusual and very thought-provoking concepts that certainly answer many of the unanswerable questions. So why don't you pick up and cover some of the things that you think are so important tonight?
Well, I guess we could comment on the Mombasa bombing in Kenya. It's a very fairly unstable country. Terrorists targeted Jews primarily. It was a Jewish-owned hotel, and it wasn't Al Al airline. It was a private Israeli airline.
Okay.
But nevertheless, its security is provided by the same people that provide security for Al Al, so we can presume that much of the same security measures are taken there. Now, the Al Al aircraft have on at least half their fleet. They have 30 aircraft and frontline airliners, and at least half of those have jamming equipment for missiles, as well as decoys, flares, chaff, other types of built-in decoys to the tail of the aircraft, plus the electronic sensors that will automatically emit flares or chaff if a missile is on the way. I have not yet been able to determine if, in fact, that's how this aircraft escaped coming down with a Strela missile. It was a Soviet-made missile, Strela variety, or at least a Soviet design. It was probably a Czechoslovakian-made missile. And it's the same type that they used to try to take out Perez on an Al Al flight that was going to Prague. So this is not the first time that this has been used, though the media, you know, is painting it as if it's the first, and it's amazing what the drumbeat is within the newspapers and the administration now to mandate that all airliners put in this equipment to deter a missile attack on an airliner. It is the only effective way, frankly, to avoid this attack. The larger question is, why hasn't this occurred before? They have thousands of missiles in the terrorist community. This is a very simple thing to shoot down an airline. They could have shot down numerous U.S. airliners anytime they wanted, airliners that fly into Israel that don't have the protection that Al Al has. They fly into Turkey. They fly into every one of these countries, you know, where there are really a danger. So that's the bigger question. I've posed it several times before, and I know you and I have discussed this. If we have, as the CIA claims, 70,000 estimated trained terrorists in the United States, why have there not been any trained terrorist attack since 9/11? A major question that really the administration has no answer for.
And which I don't think most Americans are asking that question, you know, because, of course, we're constantly besieged with these stories that, you know, it's not a matter of if the next attack is coming, when it's going to come. And, you know, we get our terrorist attack of the week or at least a terrorist attack of the month, which really is just as efficient psychologically as a real terrorist attack. And the question is, if all these terrorists are here, why aren't there all these attacks?
Yes, you know, it was very interesting. I posed this question one week, and within a few days, and I know that's not probably because they read my World Affairs brief, but because this is something that is disturbing a fair amount of people, and was getting back to the powers that be, but on the Jim Lehrer News Hour, he interviewed Vice President Cheney, and he asked them things that they never usually ask. These are the tough questions. Why, Vice President Cheney, if there is all this terrorist threat, haven't we had any terrorist attacks since 9/11? He asked that very question to Cheney. And I thought, oh, is this going to be interesting? And sure enough, Cheney says, well, we've got them on the run. You know, we've attacked their training camps in Afghanistan, and we've heightened our security here in the United States. Well, Jim Lehrer let him off easy with that answer. If I were doing the interview, I'd say, now, wait a minute. Despite aircraft security, despite it, we don't have any level of patrol within our malls in the city. We don't have any level of patrols down the streets or on power lines or any of those things. And in Israel, where they have 100 times more security, they have these car bombings and suicide bombings nearly daily. So that really doesn't answer, Mr. Vice President. But, you know, they let him off easy. In other words, the purpose of Jim Lehrer was to ask the tough questions, to give the Vice President a chance to defuse those questions with a very simplistic answer and without any follow-up. And that's exactly what happened. So this was propagandizing the world. But clearly, as I pointed out in my World Affairs brief in that issue a couple of months ago, I said, I am convinced that this is controlled terrorism here. In other words, the terrorists that are here, even those of Middle Eastern descent, are working in kind of a third-party relationship with agent provocateurs who have a globalist agenda right within our own government. It's not that the Iraqis or the Middle Easterners know that they're directly or indirectly controlled by CIA or the dark side elements within the government, but that the higher-ups at the Osama bin Laden level and his henchmen who have been seen meeting with the CIA, who the CIA and the U.S. government has not seriously attempted to capture. I think that's where the control happens. And, the terrorists down at the ground level think that they are, really running a hatred campaign against the U.S., but it is controlled in the sense that they're not being given the green light to attack, and that can only be because this is a controlled set of terrorism that's being used to promote a domestic terrorism agenda, a curtailment of U.S. constitutional rights, and a globalist agenda. That is, creating enemies and conflict so that we can justify a continued move to this globalist agenda.
In other words, the best enemies money can buy. And you know, in one of your recent World Affairs brief, you mentioned that you knew of at least three instances where people had told the government exactly where Osama bin Laden was, and in each instance, why our government really didn't want to know. In the latest issue of Insight Magazine, and anybody who wants a copy of that, we'll be glad to send you the page, there's an article saying that Arnold Borgrave, who's the senior editor, one of the senior journalists for Inside Magazine, had found out where Osama bin Laden was, and he had told George Tenet where Osama bin Laden is hiding. But interestingly enough, why we don't seem to be that interested in getting Osama bin Laden anymore. I wonder why, or maybe we never really were interested in capturing Osama bin Laden. We need him out there, the Emmanuel Goldstein of 1984, so that every time we put his picture up on the screen, everybody boos.
That's right. It's I had a Reagan administration official tell me confidentially that he had been contacted by a Pakistani group who knew precisely where bin Laden was. They knew from prior experience that the State Department wasn't interested, or at least State Department officials in Pakistan that they had approached wasn't interested in their information. They had flown to the United States, and he had assured them that he would get them an interview with Pentagon officials, and he did. And it was the same story. We're not interested.
And, of course, I guess they don't want to put out that $25 million they're offering, having a little budget problems there. So we'll say the $25 billion and a million and not get Osama bin Laden. Or maybe that $25 million is really not for Osama bin Laden. Maybe it's part of this game that they play with the minds of the American people. And maybe they're really trying to convince us they want him, whereas the reality is just exactly the opposite. Osama bin Laden is a wonderful enemy to have. And whenever we get a new tape or a new video, then we can debate, is Osama bin Laden living or is he dead? Is this really a tape from Osama bin Laden? Is this a phony tape from Osama bin Laden? But after all, if we captured him and had him in prison, how would we be able to continue playing these mind games with the American people that they're so effective at?
Well, it's interesting that you bring up the subject of the tapes. No one's asking one of the most pertinent questions relative to those tapes and videos. And that is, here Osama bin Laden's running a multi-million-dollar terrorist organization supposedly called Al-Qaeda, which in reality is a CIA creation. CIA claims that they don't have control of it anymore, but we can really dispute that, frankly, based upon the evidence. But despite this multi-million-dollar backing that he's got from Saudi Arabia, from Iran, from his own personal wealth, the presence of scrambling communication equipment plus satellite telephones, which are very, very expensive, no one's asking the question of why Osama bin Laden, if he has secret messages to relay to his terrorist groups, why he can't afford a $300 state-of-the-art video tape recorder or tape recorder to give a decent recording. We're supposed to believe that this person only has this rudimentary equipment that's spoken into in a microphone from 40 feet away so that it becomes nearly inaudible. And this stretches credibility to the extreme, Stan.
Well, I think you never want to underestimate the gullibility of the American people.
But the question is, no one's asking the question. Why is it that we never get a clear tape recording of Osama bin Laden? Why is it that it takes a super forensic audio expert from the FBI to so-called decipher his voice? And when you talk to any conventional Arab or Muslim who speaks that dialect, to say, I can't understand any of that. I can't tell whose voice that is or what he's saying. So it becomes very, very easy for the CIA to give us a story about what he's saying, and then people nod their head. As in everything with this Al-Qaeda organization, we have no evidence outside what our government tells us to corroborate any of this. And nothing from even any foreign countries.
And, of course, all we know is what we see on the news and what we read in their newspapers and their magazines and what we see on their television. And, if anybody questions that we're funding this whole thing, we've got a couple of books written in 1999, one written by a Swiss journalist called Dollars for Terror, in which he says, he's studied this thing for 4 years, traveled all over the Middle East, and, of course, who is funding this whole Islamic terrorist movement? But our good friends, the Pakistanis, Saudi Arabia, and the American CIA. And, of course, this was 1999. James Cooley, in his book on Holy Wars, talks about how we funded the Taliban in 1994. And we continued funding the Taliban, and we were still funding them in the year 2001 when George Bush addressed Congress on the 20th of September and said, we are the largest source of humanitarian aid for Afghanistan. And since the Taliban control the whole country, we were funding the Taliban still in the year 2001, and nobody ever thinks there's anything unusual about this. Once again, the best enemies money can buy.
Unfortunately, I think there's a tremendous backlog of trust that the American people have in the U.S. government because of our constitutional background. They think, because of checks and balances, that it's impossible for our government to become corrupt. Other governments have their bribery and payola and corruption, but Americans just don't believe Or if they see it in Chicago or New York, they think it's endemic to these big machine cities. But Americans are extremely naive relative to our government. And that's why certain books that expose the dark side of government and the many cover-ups that have occurred, books like Rodney Stitch's Defrauding America, are so important. There are dozens of them out there that have interviewed whistleblowers from the CIA and the DEA talking about U.S. drug trafficking and military people who flew helicopters filled with these drugs for the CIA, even involved with Iran-Contra, Oliver North, and other people, people who are viewed as conservative heroes. But, you know, Americans really need to read these things. It's not enough to have you and I tell them about it. They really need to get these books so that they get the firsthand information that really shocks them into a realization there's something very, very rotten in Denmark.
No, in fact, we interviewed Gary Webb this afternoon, who wrote Dark Alliance, and his website, which is simply gary.webb.home.attbi, that's gary.webb.home.attbi.com, has links to the CIA where you'll read about where they acknowledge that they many of their operatives were smuggling drugs and involved in this whole vast drug smuggling operation. And how many of them have been fired? How many of them have been disciplined? And, of course, none. But of course they figure the American people will never actually check that out. But get the information in Gary Webb's book, A Dark Alliance, or we carry a book where he writes an essay, which it's called Into the Buzzsaw. And the information is there. It's important that people read it and get other people to listen to it. And, of course, the beauty of what I do is you can get my two interviews now we've had with Gary Webb. Fascinating insights into what happened to a reporter who had the audacity to tell the truth.
It is fascinating. I highly recommend that to your audience as well.
And, of course, you have the advantage. You have your own publication. In fact, before I forget, why don't you tell our listeners how they can get the World Affairs Brief?
Well, the World Affairs Brief is a weekly analysis of the news, just as we're doing today, telling much about the inside information that I get from many of my sources around the world. They can check my website, joelskousen.com. That's joelskousen.com, for information about my World Affairs Brief and other books that I've written on preparedness. If they don't have access to the web, they can call my office when I'm not doing an interview like now. The area is area code 801-224-4746, and I'll be happy to send out samples of the print edition of the World Affairs Brief.
And, of course, really, it's fascinating. I always enjoy Joel's commentary because he asks those questions that Jim Laird ought to be asking, but he doesn't want to because he wants to keep his job. Now, what's your thoughts about picking Henry Kissinger to head a congressional committee? Why he would be the chair of a congressional committee, I will never know. He's never even belonged to Congress, and he's lied to them so many times, I would think he'd be ashamed of. But he's going to head this congressional committee to get the truth to the American people. And as it said in this latest issue of the New York Times, the widely respected Henry Kissinger. Who respects Henry Kissinger? Well, obviously the president respects him or expects him to give the proper answers and not to get to the bottom of this. If they really wanted to get to the bottom of this, they would have let Congress appoint the chair of the committee and let Congress form the committee, but the president refused to allow Congress to investigate whether the administration knew about the attack and allowed it to happen, because that's what it's really all about. And the questions is never asked, who ordered the planes, the fighter planes, not to try to intercept the hijacked planes? How did the FBI know within 2 hours of the attack where the hijackers were, who they were, where they lived, the restaurants they went to, the neighborhoods they lived in? How could that happen in 2 hours when they didn't even know who the hijackers were? Come on now, do you really believe that's the case? And unfortunately, an awful lot of Americans simply can find it impossible to believe that anybody could be so ruthless that they would allow an attack to take place and 3,000 Americans to die. But you have to understand, it's really for the greater good. And what's the greater good? why Gary Hart said on the 14th, addressing a group of members of this Council on Foreign Relations in Washington, D.C., that President of the United States may have a chance to use this disaster to create what his father discussed, and I think only once, and that is a new world order. And if you want to actually see the video clip, it's contained in a video we have called The Great Deception. The President of the United States may be able to use this disaster to bring about what his father discussed, and I think only once, and that is the new world order.
Well, there's apparently a lot that White House does not want Congress to even come close to testifying. The White House has lobbied and tried to sabotage this investigation. As you know, it got knocked out of the domestic security bill, but an independent commission, this particular independent commission, was put back in at the last moment due to some heavy lobbying by the survivor groups. So they were, you know, basically reinstated in a separate intelligence spending bill after, you know, this heavy lobbying. But, you know, it's interesting, the Bush administration has been maintaining for several months that it doesn't want an independent commission. And now that Congress has overruled the president and mandated it, the Bush administration really has just tried to sabotage this process by putting in someone who is obviously not just a predictable yes man like Ken Starr was in whitewashing the Clinton investigation. But, you know, for some reason or other, they've gone to one of what I consider the second-level controllers in this dark side of government. I mean, Kissinger is well above George Bush. And so this may not have been George Bush's call. In essence, the higher-ups may have said, we want somebody absolutely predictable, because this is so essential that the American people never realize that the their own government may have had a large role in making sure that this attack occurred. The other question, though, that comes up, because of all the baggage that Kissinger has, especially his reputation among the left, I'm not sure the right, you know, the Birch Society knows a great deal about the background of Henry Kissinger, but the general conservative right doesn't so much. Because he was aligned with President Nixon when President Nixon was under attack. He worked for Ford, and none of that rings any warning bells. They fail to remember that in the background of Kissinger, he was regarded by us hardline conservatives as one of the greatest betrayers of liberty. For example, we now know that there were secret deals that Kissinger made in the ending days of the Vietnam War, despite the fact that the Vietnamese were ready to capitulate in the Paris Peace Conference because of the bombing of Hanoi, which was very effective. They were ready to throw in the towel. Kissinger simply gave it all away to them and negotiated an extremely one-sided secret treaty with the Red Chinese, which had three basic parts to it. One, that he would refuse, or the U.S. would refuse to support Taiwanese independence if China would back out of the war. Number two, that Red China would be allowed to replace Taiwan in the UN, which happened. And three, that the U.S. would remain silent about U.S. prisoners of war that were still being held captive in Vietnam, in Russia, and in China, which the U.S. knew about and has consistently covered up since then. I think it's important to remember that Kissinger was also responsible for convincing Nixon to order the ban on the exportation of miniature ball-bearing technology to the Soviet Union lifted. He lifted the ban. That ban, which up until that time had kept the Russians from developing accurate MIRV warheads on nuclear missiles. So, interestingly enough, Kissinger was also responsible, after having allowed the Russians to arm their missiles with multiple warheads, then to push through the ABM Treaty in 1972 so that the U.S. could not respond to this increasing Russian threat. Now, either this is stupidity, as some people like J.R. Nyquist would think, or it's collusion and conspiracy at its very worst, as Joel Skousen maintains.
Well, I certainly, there are many, many people who always felt that Kissinger was a Soviet agent. There was, in fact, the highest-ranking person, some fellow defected back in 1960 to Canada, and they exposed, I think, 5 Soviet spy rings, and one of the things he said was Henry Kissinger was a Soviet agent. Now, I don't know whether it's true or not. Certainly, he's an agent of the Rockefellers, but then the Rockefellers have been financing communism since its inception, family, and we know that Henry Kissinger is deeply involved with the occult. According to the article we have in West Magazine, he was a frequent visitor at Lubbock in Colorado, the occult enclave where the medicine men and the shamans and the occultists throughout the world would go, and organized by Marie Strong. And there was Henry Kissinger and his good buddy Robert McNamara there, going frequently to pay homage to Marie Strong and his wife, who is a witch, incidentally. Marie Strong's wife was an avowed witch. So certainly, as you point out, I believe that Henry Kissinger is part of this whole spiritual hierarchy that rules the world, and you may well be right. It is so vitally important that they keep the American people in the dark just a little bit longer.
Well, I have a little bit alternate view on the Kissinger-communist connection.
All right, fine.
Indeed, he was fingered as a communist agent, because he did, in fact, go into Eastern Germany and maintain contacts for several years. But modern revelations out of the intelligence community indicate that Kissinger was actually assigned to do so by the OSS, to go and infiltrate communist ranks and serve as a U.S. double agent. Now, he served in this role during the FDR administration under the auspices of another double agent, which was Alger Hiss. Now, conservatives then would like to believe, hopefully, that he was serving as a double agent. It was actually still loyal to our side. But in my view, I think that people like Kissinger and Hiss, even though they did join the Communist Party secretly and maintain that secret, that they were actually doing so not because they were really communists, but because they were working for the globalist New World Order. In other words, purpose was to actually facilitate Russian and East German espionage back into U.S. circles, them thinking, of course, that Kissinger was one of theirs and he was facilitating theirs. In fact, the Russians have always patted themselves on the back and said, gee, how easy it is to infiltrate the CIA and the FBI, how stupid these Americans are. What they don't realize is that in the Hegelian conflict of these globalist leaders in our country, they've actually paved the way and helped these agents. I mean, why do you think that they didn't reveal Robert Hansen's identity? The CIA knew he was a spy for 15 years. Why did they let him keep going? It was to continue to allow those Russians to think that they're stronger than they are, once again, building up Russian capabilities, building an enemy so that they can tackle them in this next global conflict, which will come after a Russian preemptive nuclear strike, and the globalists will pull out their secret weapons and then go to war, and it will usher in a new world order, all in the name of knee-jerk patriotism, God, country, and family. And our leaders will come out of their bunkers and they'll claim that they were deceived, that they never knew that the Russians were harboring all these weapons. We know that they know the Russians are harboring these weapons. We know that the Russians have these secret, huge underground bunkers and the CIA satellite photos, and they continue to cover for the Russians. There has to be a reason for that. And I think it's that they're playing this double, triple entendre game, keeping the Russians confused, keeping the Americans confused, thinking that we're fighting communism, while in fact we've been facilitating it, and eventually going to fight it, just as we did Hitler. We built up the best enemy we could buy, as you so cogently put it, and then we went to war against Hitler. And even though the big capitalists had some of their plants destroyed in Europe, they were the first ones to get the concessions by the Marshall Plan in order to rebuild, and became wealthy once again after the war.
And you know, there's a fascinating book out. It's called Gestapo Chief. It's a story of a man named Heinrich Mueller, who I always thought that Heinrich Himmler was the head of the German Gestapo, but the Gestapo was really headed by a man named Heinrich Mueller, and Himmler was in charge of over Mueller as far as all of these internal security organizations. But Heinrich Mueller, the head of the wicked Gestapo, was brought to the United States after the Second World war, had a plus job, and lived out comfortably, despite all of his war crimes and his Nazi Party membership and support for the Nazis. He lived up in Berkeley and Piedmont in California, and is buried in the same cemetery as my grandmother. And, of course, this would be so disturbing for the American people to realize that we would bring the head of the Gestapo here. There's a very interesting article in the American Heritage magazine criticizing the author of the book, Gestapo Chief, Mr. Gregory Douglas, for daring to bring this out. He didn't deny it was true, but we couldn't let the American people know that we, of course, were working with the head of the Gestapo. We'll be right back here in just a moment with Joel Skousen, and invite your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and this is the time when we have to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we depend upon those of you who listen to our programs and believe in what we're doing, and we really want to see other people begin to think, to join in this epic struggle and help us as we, 5 hours every day, reach out across America with the information you're not going to get elsewhere. So if you believe there's a problem and you'd like to join us, why give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. We'd be glad to send you a free copy of my October newsletter, which is the testimony of Kristen Breitweiser before the Senate Intelligence Committee, the testimony that was so carefully suppressed by the controlled media. Our September newsletter, of course, deals with what's really going on, forces behind the September 11th attack last year, and how this all fits into, of course, not the war on terrorism, but the war on the American people, and how, of course, the terrorist attack is used to get the USA Patriot Act through the Office of Homeland Security enacted. And, of course, you're never hearing what's being said back in Washington, D.C. By Harry Byrd, who is trying to say we're doing away with checks and balances. We're giving this tremendous centralized authority to Washington, D.C. We're doing away with civil service protection, which, of course, means that there's no longer whistleblower protection for anybody in government who tries to bring out treachery and deceit and deception at the highest level of our government. So, you know, you here on Radio Liberty, you're going to hear things you're not going to hear elsewhere. And as long as God gives us breath and a microphone, we'll be here bringing out the information. But quite frankly, we need your help. So give us a call at 1-800-544. If you're interested in being part of this, if you'd like to get our newsletter, free copy of it, we'll be glad to send it to you. And perhaps you'll want to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters as we reach out 5 hours every day with the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Remember our website at radioliberty.com. That's www.radioliberty.com. We post our newsletters there. We post essays there. We post our archive programs, and you can listen 5 hours a day either on Radio Liberty or linking to americanewsnet.com or gcnlive.com. Encourage others to listen. Help us to get the word out, because, of course, if you don't help, who will? And if not now, when? We'll be right back here with Joel Skousen here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest is Joel Skousen of White's World Affairs Brief. And I was just thinking the other day, you know, the Korean War was really a no-win war. And if you analyze it and you read MacArthur's reminiscences, you'll find we did everything we could to help the communists and never tried to win that war. We put our 7th Fleet between Formosa and the mainland, not to keep the Chinese communists from invading Formosa, or Taiwan, as we call it today, but to keep the Taiwanese from invading the mainland so that they could turn a million-man Chinese army loose, bring them up into Manchuria, to bring them down to kill our boys. We weren't allowed to bomb the major bridges. And even the head of the Chinese troop, General Lin Biao, acknowledged that he never would have attached across the Yalu and risked his troops if he hadn't been guaranteed that Washington would restrain General MacArthur from retaliating against his supply lines. It's all there in MacArthur's reminiscences. The Vietnam was a no-win war. The war on drugs is a no-win war. The war on AIDS is a no-win war. And in Botswana today, 50% of the women ages 20 to 35 who come in for prenatal examinations, they're all infected. This is either a genocidal war or the greatest public health failure of all time, but we're continuing exactly the same policies, so it couldn't be that we feel that they're unsuccessful. We're killing off Africa in the name of a war on AIDS. And now, of course, we have a war on terrorism. But how do you have a war on terrorism? Terrorism is an act. It is not something you fight against. I mean, you fight against countries. You have wars with countries, and certainly the countries that have been financing the Al-Qaeda, this terrorist movement, have been Saudi Arabia and Pakistan and the CIA. Maybe we're going to war with the wrong country, or maybe nothing as it appears to be. So why don't you pick up your thoughts from there, Joel?
I'd like to comment on a couple of things. First of all, going back to the problem in the Korean War, there were dozens of general officers that saw the betrayals that were going on and knew what was happening, but kept their silence because of the false allegiance they had to the military hierarchical chain of command. Our military people, and myself included, when I was in the military, are not taught anything about the specifics of where an illegal order is, why it is illegal, and because of the extreme allegiance to secrecy in the military, whenever a higher-up says this is top secret or national, you know, you just clam up. We need much more whistleblowing in the United States military, and I know that there are military people that see things going on right now because I get a lot of emails from active-duty military people who get my World Affairs briefs or see them and feed me information, and it's very, very disturbing because they all say, I don't dare utter any of this. In fact, I've even got some employees in U.S. embassies around the world who take my brief and have to go so far as to have it sent to another email address so that the government doesn't see them receiving my material. But they are very interested in it, and they know that what I'm saying is true. They see a lot of it themselves, but can't seem to do anything about it other than to resign or protest. I wish that more would resign and protest, because I know that more and more our young men are going to have to face real decisions of violations of conscience if they continue to go and do battle with people who are relatively innocent compared to our own globalist government. Then you also mentioned about the controlled press, and I've got a couple of instances in this week's World Affairs Brief that might be of interest to your leaders, where we had a couple slip-ups with the press, and they let out some truth. And it's interesting to watch how they react to it. Here's an example of Robert Siegel in NPR's All Things Considered was interviewing the Iraqi National Congress leader, Intifad Kanbar. And he was saying, it was very interesting, he was openly playing the devil's advocate so that he could get away with criticizing him to his face without appearing critical. He'd say, now I'm going to play the devil's advocate. I'm going to talk about your failures and ask you a little bit about this and this. And he was very cocky and very confident about it, trying to be careful. And he says, why after 10 years haven't we seen any progress from the INC, the Iraqi National Congress, in overthrowing Saddam Hussein? And Kanbar replied that Siegel was overlooking the facts. He said, in 1995, the INC launched a very successful attack, capturing thousands of prisoners and high-ranking officers. But the U.S. backed out. The U.S. sent us a telegram saying, you're on your own, just a few hours before the next attack.
Now, when was that?
This was 1995.
1995, fine, because there's a book by Robert Byrd, former CIA station chief in northern Iraq, who mentioned in 1993 and again in 1995, we betrayed the Iraqi military who wanted to overthrow Saddam Hussein. And I think that's fascinating that that was brought out. And the average American doesn't understand. The Iraqis have been trying to overthrow Saddam Hussein, and we've been keeping him in power.
That's right. But what was very interesting is the reaction of Siegel. Here he'd asked a question. He expected, of course, Kanbar to say, well, you know, we just haven't had the resources, and, you know, generic. But he came out right out and said, we got a telegram from the U.S. State Department saying you're on your own, just a few hours to the attacks, and then there was no more funding, no more military intelligence, no more military assistance. And then Kambar went right on, related another example. In 1996, he says, Saddam Hussein invaded the Kurdish region to the north, and because the CIA had armed the northern Kurds and was giving them military assistance, as soon as Saddam Hussein started to attack, the CIA said pulled out all of their support, and the Kurdish opposition collapsed, leaving them to be defeated. Now, if you were a reporter, Stan, and somebody had dropped a bombshell like this on you, that the state, you would at least say, why, Mr. Kambar, do you think that the State Department pulled out all the support? I mean, here we are. I mean, it would raise all kinds of questions in your mind.
I mean, we're supposed to be against the wicked Saddam Hussein. We're hoping that people in Saudi Arabia will overthrow him. And every time they try, why, we undercut them.
But incredibly, Robert Siegel showed virtually no sign of surprise. He didn't bat an eye. It was as if he was just as cool as he could be. He simply went on and changed the subject. Didn't even show any protest, didn't answer, didn't comment on what he said.
Where is this interview? I would love to get a copy of it.
This is an interview that took place almost 2 weeks ago. You can find it on the NPR website.
NPR, right?
Yeah, NPR, All Things Considered, under Robert Siegel. And just look for his interview with Intifad Kambar.
Who is Mr. Kambar?
Kambar is the principal leader of the coalition, the Iraqi National Congress.
And that's
he is their director.
And that's Mr. Siegel?
That's Robert Siegel.
Robert Siegel. All right, fine.
It's S-I-E-G-E-L. Anyway, there was another one that happened that was very interesting. This is when, you know, the book by Bob Woodward on Bush at War is
right.
Just the rage. It's in all the bookstores. I was flying back in the airport, just full of these things. Biggest propaganda for a book promotion I've seen in a long time. And normally, Bob Woodward is hired to destroy presidents. And he does this because he is one of those journalists who is on secret retainer from the CIA. There's dozens of them. Every one of your great so-called investigative reporters are great because they get insider information. And the only way they get that information is because the CIA feeds it to them. They're the ones who make or break these big-name people. You know, it just has been going on for many, many years. Whenever you look at who's going out to destroy a president, when they attacked Batista, when Christopher Matthews?
Herbert Matthews, you're talking about.
Oh, right. Herbert Matthews,
right,
yes,
right.
Of the New York Times. He was the hatchet man there, and then there was, during Somoza, when he was being crucified in the press here, made to look like an ogre, there was, it slips my mind now who the reporter was there. He since claimed that he made a turn, you know, repented and gone to the conservative side, but he's never admitted that that he was a knowing, or what his leftist or CIA sources were involving Somoza. But in any case, Bob Woodward is one of these who has these secret ties. And in fact, it's very telling that the book, Bush at War, if there's two people that really come out glowing with praise and they couldn't do anything wrong, it was Secretary of Colin Powell and the CIA, which is what the propaganda value was for. But Bush, of course, is promoted heavily in this book, too, which is very, very strange because Bob Woodward is a globalist, a socialist, an anti-Republican. He's always been pro-Democrat. And here he is lauding and praising, in so many words, George Bush because he's a globalist. Most interviewers were fed the question to ask Bob Woodward, what is it during your interview with the president that most surprised you? And usually, Woodward, with Larry King and with CNN News and with Fox News, had said, what surprised me was the depth of the religious conviction of this president, the sincerity when we talk about God and his religion. Now, Bob Woodward doesn't care a hoot about religion. He would normally be derisive of any one religion. Here he was praising Bush, which shows that the greatest propaganda value of this book was aimed at conservatives, to try to keep conservatives wedded to this president who is out warmongering in the world. But interesting enough, in his interview with Terry Gross on the woefully misnamed NPR program Fresh Air, Anything But Fresh, she asked him what was most surprising or telling in Woodward's conversation with the president. He said this, I'm going to quote, overall that he has a vision of almost wanting to remake the world. This idea that American leadership is going to be shaping the shaping force in the world. He wants to be the liberator in countries where people are oppressed. He maintains his goal of world peace, that he is concerned about mothers and starving children, and that there is a determination at one point, maybe it's religion, maybe it's his gut instinct, maybe it's visceral, that he feels that either you worry about freedom and the human condition or you don't. It's almost a Woodrow Wilson-like view in creating a new world order that the Bush expressed to me. And I didn't expect him to outline this. Well, I think he was being disingenuous by saying he didn't expect it. That was the whole purpose of promoting the president's agenda, was to put him forth as a gushing globalist, a new world order agenda that his father had begun. And while conservatives would like to believe that Bush simply views the global UN juggernaut with rose-colored glasses, naively blind to its dangers and faults, they are really engaging in wishful thinking. I'm convinced that this skull and bones conspirator, brought up from obscurity by a controlled media, is engaged in deception, playing the role of a Christian and compassionate conservative while engaging in multiple violations of citizens' constitutional rights, and stirring up unprecedented hate and discontent against the United States abroad through this constant intervention. And I think it will eventually end up in a global world war. But true to form, Bush does have a globalist agenda, and Bob Woodward really admitted it. Conservatives ought to be very concerned.
You know, it's so interesting. You commented on that when I talked to you this morning. And I take the weekend edition of the Washington Post. I can't stand reading it every day, but they summarize all their important articles in the weekend edition. And the latest one was talking about really this wonderful president that we have underestimated. And they likened George Bush to Ronald Reagan. And they said, you know, here's a man who really can't even pronounce words correctly. And yet, of course, he has this wonderful leadership ability. And we have really underestimated him like we underestimated Ronald Reagan. Why, he may be one of our greatest presidents. And I'm reading this. And of course, you have to understand that the Washington Post is, you know, a straight Bilderberger, a CFR, Trilateral Commission publication. It's part of the publication of the spiritual hierarchy that, in my estimation, rules the world. You all would call it the dark side of government. Doesn't matter what you call it. But they are coming out. Here, there's a straight liberal Democratic paper is coming out praising George Bush as, underestimated. And I'm reading this and I'm saying, I don't believe this. I mean, supposedly we have two political parties and the Washington Post represents the other side, and now they're supporting the Republican president. I wonder how many conservative Christians are reading this and wondering, are thinking, boy, isn't it wonderful? Even the Washington Post is coming around. Rather, what they should be saying is, oh, my God, I've been betrayed.
Even my brother's been taken in on this. You know, he writes the newsletter Forecast and Strategies, and I was telling him about, it was an argument over this Rudolph Giuliani thing where he was being viewed by some conservatives as someone who's been a great mayor of New York, despite the fact that he was pro-homosexual and pro-abortion and pro-gun control. But nevertheless, you know, he supposedly cleaned up New York, and New York is a lot better place now because of Giuliani. And so I was retorting, and I said, look, Mark, when Time magazine puts Giuliani on the front cover as Man of the Year, you know the establishment has plans for this man. This is a globalist. This is a person who's a conspirator with those, and he's going to be a presidential candidate someday. And they don't do that to true conservatives. They don't do that to people on our side. And he said, well, what do you mean? Time magazine's really making a turnabout. The editor, in fact, is a fan, he said, of Milton Friedman. He quotes him all the time. I said, you've got to understand, Mark, that the globalists themselves are using free trade. They're playing like they're free market people, that they really are pro this, just to put you people to sleep and to think that you're winning this game. But in fact, they're using the free market as bait only to increase their credibility and to lessen the opposition from the conservatives and the people who are pro-free market, but it's a trap.
You know, Joel, what really bothers me is so many good people, and I know of your brother, I've met him, and he's a wonderful person, a great patriot, but he just doesn't understand. And I run into this all the time with these honest Christian conservatives who love America and love freedom, and they are so gullible, they are so taken in, they cannot accept the fact that nothing is as it appears to be.
Well, they want to believe in these illusions because to do otherwise is really very, very discouraging. I mean, it's tough to understand how deep and how desperate the battle really is, but you and I both know that it's made more difficult for us when we have to fight not only the deceptiveness of the left and not openly championing their devious agenda, but we have to fight the apathy that comes from our own conservatives who want to believe in these illusions. They're wanting to believe that, in fact, they'll never have to fight, that God will save them, that all they have to do is passively rely upon God. Now, certainly, we can't do it without God. We know that. But to a certain extent, because this earth is a test life, God allows a great deal to occur, and part of that's left for us to do. Because if we don't do it, God will surely let us fall.
Well, I hope and pray he's going to intervene, but I certainly wouldn't guarantee it right now. Right now we've got Jeannie on the line. Hi, Jeannie, how you doing? Hi, Jeannie. Jeannie, are you there? We just lost Jeannie. Well, hopefully we'll get Jeannie back on again. Don't know what happened there. Anyway, certainly we are having real problems today because, of course, this whole thing is being presented by patriotism. We've got to strike now against Saddam Hussein because he's a wicked dictator. And really uses a terrible force. And, he has no human compassion and he kills his opponents. But so does so many of the other dictators we put in power. And nobody is really concerned about them. I mean,
let me interject at one point. I heard the president speaking today and he was talking about at the Pentagon how horrible it was. He says, Saddam Hussein isn't in compliance. He was responding to the press saying that, gee, he's complying with the inspectors. He says he isn't responding. Why, he's even firing on U.S. and British aircraft in the no-fly zone. What the president failed to say was, is that these aircraft are not just passively flying around over Iraq, turning circles high up in the air. These people are making practice runs as if they're making bombing runs on installations. And they're doing that to draw fire from Saddam Hussein so they can run back to the press and say, we were fired upon, and now we've got an excuse to go in and blow up another installation, another airfield for Saddam Hussein. But they're actually out there antagonizing Saddam Hussein by doing mock bombing runs at installations to draw their fire.
Well,
that is real disingenuous, evil lying to the American people.
Well, we've got Jeannie on his cell phone. Jeannie, a question or comment?
Oh, I wanted to ask Joel Skousen, the propaganda that came from for Somoza, was that not Jack Anderson from the Washington Post?
That's the name. It certainly was, and I thank you very much, Jeannie. It was Jack Anderson who claimed to, during the Reagan administration, to have an epiphany, kind of a revelation warning him about how close he was to losing his soul over what he's done. He claimed to make a come around, and he has become semi-conservative since then. But he's never admitted to his dark side contacts, and I don't ever let anyone off the hook unless they admit that they crucified. He was responsible more than anyone for crucifying Somoza and turning him into an evil man that could be overthrown when he was, in fact, a very good man and a defender of liberty in his country.
Okay, anything else, Jeannie?
Well, there was a good book written about that. It was called Nicaragua Betrayed by Jack Cox. And I might say, Dr. Stan, I do get Joel Skousen's newsletter, and I have a little insight into Central America, and I'll tell you, he's about the only one that really understands what's happening.
Well, that's why. So, why do you think we have him on our program so often?
So, Joel, thank you very much.
Thank you, Jeannie.
Thank you, Jeannie.
Bye-bye. And Jeannie, that's a testimonial, an unsolicited testimonial, but I agree with her. I think you have an excellent insight into what's happening, and I'm always fascinated by your commentary. In fact, for our listeners, I do read this food every week when it comes. We get it by email. It's called World Affairs Brief, and of course, if you'd like to get more information, the telephone number is 801-224-4746. That 801-224-4746. And we put Joel on simply because we think his information is valid and we want you to hear it. And of course, you have to understand as we open our program every day, reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. And really, so much is perception, and they are playing games with our mind, they're playing games with our reality, and so many of people have been able to convince that black is white, white is black, and of course that all we have to do is simply go to war, and everything's going to be fine. It's going to be a very brief war. Our boys will be home by Christmas, as they say. Well, they said that at the time of the Boer War in 1899, and 3 years later, the boys were home. 100,000 British casualties later. Let's go to Herman calling from Carmel. We're just about out of time. Hi, Herman. How are you doing?
Very good. Excellent guest. I tuned in late, but did Joel discuss Red Mercury at all or the possibility of some type of high explosive device going off here at home?
You're talking really about this special
suitcase
type of
nukes.
Do you have any thoughts on that at all? Some sort of one of these bombs that kills people but not property?
Well, I've actually investigated the Red Mercury thing quite in detail and have found that it really is not a valid. It's really some disinformation that's been thrown out about this Red Mercury invention, even though. Our good friend Cohen, one of the Neutron bomb, says he thinks it's valid. He doesn't know for sure, I've found out. He's simply, you know, presuming. But I have found that none of these suitcase nukes, in fact, are missing from Russia. That's just been disinformation. They have to be under constant maintenance. There's no way that a terrorist could have possession of those and still have them in working order for very long because they are very high-tech. Things. I believe that most of these things are scare tactics to once again justify more of this anti-terrorism provisions by the government, especially among the conservative community.
And I really think so. Joel's absolutely right. They're trying to scare us to death, Herman. Not that there isn't a fear. Not that there may not be a biological and chemical warfare, but if it comes, it'll be allowed to come.
And it will become because the Russians will do it, or agent provocateurs in our own system will do it, but not because the terrorists do it independently. They're very, very controlled. I think the fact that we haven't had any terrorism since 9/11 proves that they're under strict control. And there's no reason why, if it were the control of the Middle East, why they wouldn't be attacking. It's only if they're under the control of our own government that they wouldn't be attacking us.
And that's the neutron bomb you're talking about with the Red Mercury there. Anything else, Herman?
Neutron bomb is a different animal than the Red Mercury. Red Mercury allows for a miniaturization of a highly explosive device that's even more powerful than nuclear. That's the hypothesis, but I have not found credible evidence that, in fact, that has been produced or is in production.
All right, anything else, Herman?
Are you available on the Internet, your newsletter?
Yes, it comes by email on the Internet.
And that's how you get it on the Internet, but you have to subscribe to it.
There's a lot of subscription fee, and you can see that on my website, joelskousen.com.
Okay, we're out of time. Thanks very much, Herman.
Thank you.
Okay, fine. Well, we're just about out of time. Do you have any parting thoughts for our listeners? Well, I don't even think we have time for our parting thoughts. Anyway,
I want to appreciate what you're doing, Steve.
Well, I want to tell you how much I appreciate you coming on and being with us here. And we'll be talking to you later this week. So if you're out there in the listening audience, just check our schedule up on the Internet at RadioLiberty.com, and Joel will be with us later. Bye-bye. God bless you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, fine. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when, of course, we ask you to pray for America. We ask you to pray for revival, because if the American people don't turn back to God, why, God will turn his back on the American people. We ask you to pray for our leaders and our ministers, but we ask you to pray specifically for Radio Liberty for our provision and for our protection. And so until tomorrow at the same time, when we'll be back with you once again, Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you.
They do look a little bleak, don't they? But well, all we can do is just keep persisting, and hopefully more and more people are beginning to know something is wrong. The appellate jurisdiction, really, you have to look it up in the dictionary, but my understanding is that has to do with anything that is not, dealing with the states or with foreign countries, but very, very specifically, this would be all these, anything that really is outside the